Today, Guardian columnist Owen Jones on facing abuse both on and offline. And Britain's most prolific rapist is jailed for life.
So it was my 35th birthday, low point. And I was with a group of friends, and we went for a nightcap, just, you know, the last dregs of us, basically, a pub with a late license, the sort of place you go to just because nowhere else is open. And we were there just 45 minutes. And then we left at 2 o'clock. And I remember this vividly. We were only about a minute or two down the road. And all of a sudden, I just remember being on the ground, staring at the sky with a very painful head, completely bewildered, had no idea what was happening. If it was like a film with subtitles, the subtitles would be general chaos, lots of screaming and yelling. Three of my friends were punched in the head whilst trying to defend me. And what the CCTV showed was they came from the pub, these three men, kicked me to the ground and then tried to drag me away from my friends. And when they tried to defend me, they were punched in the head. One of my friends yelled, "We've called the police," that they scarpered. I remember them scarpering down a road, almost kind of drunk on adrenaline. And that was the... It was almost though everything had been building up to that point. And I think, unfortunately, the likelihood is it won't be the last time it happens either.
The horrendous attack that Guardian columnist Owen Jones is describing happened in August last year. In December, three men admitted to the charge of affray. Next week, a judge will decide whether one of them, James Healy, was motivated by Owen's sexuality. The reason Owen doesn't think it will be the last time he's attacked is that he's now become accustomed to being a target, in person and online. In the past year, he's been repeatedly taunted in the street, including homophobic abuse. He believes that some cases have involved far-right activists. And then there's Twitter. Over Christmas, thousands of people fired abusive messages at him on the social media site as part of a plan to get an offensive hashtag trending. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Owen Jones on toxic politics and becoming a target for abuse. Owen, you've got over 900,000 followers on Twitter. That makes you a massive celebrity.
Scraping the barrel a little bit there.
You're the most famous person I know.
Again, you really are scraping the barrel there.
And you first became a public figure when you wrote a book in 2011 called Chavs, The Demonisation of the Working Class. What was the response to you in public back then?
Oh my word, it's like a different universe. It really feels like a different planet because I never expected that book to have the impact it did at the time. And then it was suddenly getting reviewed and getting good reviews. And what happened then is newspapers said, "Do you want to write for us on this book?" And to go on TV to talk about it or radio. And then they said, "Do you want to write about other things as well, other issues?" So I became, I guess, at that time in the kind of pre-2015, pre-Corbyn era, the kind of token lefty on TV, the kind of go-to lefty, depends how you see it, commentator or gobby little so-and-so. So then, you know, I remember I went, you know, on Question Time for the first time in 2012.
The columnist on The Independent, Owen Jones.
It got this big explosive response.
"There is a rising tide of anti-Muslim prejudice which dresses itself up in secularism, and that is a serious point right, which I think we need to address."
There was this reception amongst people who wanted to be Labour in particular, to be more radical and more anti-austerity and all the rest of it, to listen to me. On the other side, there was that group of people who were not so enamoured, to say the least.
"Hang on a second, we've heard a lot from you. Let me tell you something. I didn't hear you screaming about 2.5 million people who are parked. Nobody saw them."
So I would say from about 2012 onwards, far-right types, and at the time it was principally the English Defence League and followers of Tommy Robinson, and that bit certainly hasn't changed, increasingly saw me as a hate figure.
And since then, you've built this huge social media following, and we've seen over Christmas what that can mean in terms of attacks against you. When you log on, what kind of things do you see?
Lots of the time, it's people just being very, you know, friendly or supportive. Others very critical, just very strongly opposed to the stuff I believe in, which is obviously what you'd expect in a democracy. But other stuff is often vitriolically homophobic, often violent fantasies, things these people would like to do to me. And obviously that also includes death threats. And that's something which has got worse and worse and worse over the last few years, particularly in the last 3 years.
And in fact, I'm looking at a message that you've shared on your Twitter over the weekend, which is typical, a person kind of rambling on, but within that saying, "I've been paid to kill you. If you go to the police, you'll die." How do messages like that make you feel?
Obviously, I'm a human being. I've got an inevitable human response, which is, you know, it's kind of emotionally quite exhausting to, you know, you kind of, in my head, sometimes I wonder about the level of hatred that is in, you know, possess someone to kind of write those sorts of things. I find it just very wearisome. If I find the death threats tedious because, you know, I've been strongly advised that I do need to report them to the police when they seem quite serious. And that is a bureaucratic process. You know, I'm very appreciative of the officers who come around to my flat, but that's what, you know, I have to do an appointment. They come round, they take a witness statement, you know, and it is, you know, it's got more and more exhausting.
Obviously, one of the common threads here is social media. How much of a role do you think that has played in just changing the tone of public debate?
I think social media often reflects the kind of broader divisions and polarisation that exists in society, whilst also entrenching it. And, you know, polarisation would have happened without social media because of big social and economic events that have taken place in our different societies. But obviously social media allows that polarisation to kind of almost inhabit the daily lives of all of us.
And I feel that it also amplifies what you're talking about, because it's the most polarised debate of all. Recently, when I sent a tweet about Islamophobia, it was so awful, the kind of overwhelming response I got attacking the comment and also me personally, that it bled into my weekend. Mm. It affected my ability to spend time with my family and enjoy myself. I had that phone coming out of my pocket, looking again, how many notifications? Oh, another 100 notifications. Oh, another 100 notifications. And I felt physically stressed. And so as a result, yeah, I go on social media and I do a bit of it, but I personally censor myself when it comes to certain issues. Do you never feel tempted to do that?
I mean, that is horrific, by the way. And there is, you know, this is why it's very important that, although I can talk about my experience as a gay man, the misogyny and racism that women, that people of colour, and particularly being a woman of colour face. I mean, you see it in politics, of course, most notoriously with Diane Abbott.
And I thought to myself, you know, had I known it would be like this 30 years on from being elected, I'd have thought twice for running for Parliament at all.
But there is an attempt by men to drive women out of public life and to basically use social media to terrorise women. And I think it's very important that that is at the centre of this whole discussion and this whole debate. And I think, you know, I mean, there is self-care, obviously, which is important. And we have to look after ourselves. I think it would be very tragic if people, because of these, you know, this campaign of often very coordinated abuse, by the way, what they will do is they, far-right activists in particular, will have giant Twitter DM groups, closed Facebook groups, use online forums like 4chan to coordinate the sorts of abuse that you yourself suffered there. I just think to myself, and it's up to people how they respond, I can only talk about myself, is that I do sometimes think, oh, you know, if I write this column or article, it's kind of, you know, adopt the brace position. If I write about, you know, LGBTQ rights, for example, you know, I mean, I think, again, I can only speak as a queer person, that I know that when I was growing up as a closeted gay guy, and anyone with a public platform who used that position to speak out for my rights was like a lifeline. And I feel you know, a duty and responsibility to do that, even though I know what that will mean.
You've spoken about being targeted by the far right, but many would say that if we focus on social media as opposed to what happens in person, then there is abuse from both sides of the political spectrum.
I mean, obviously, there are people on the left who can behave in an abusive, reprehensible way. But I think sometimes abuse can be used as a unfortunate catch-all term for, I don't know, you know, criticising a politician's political record is treated as harassment or bullying in some way or abusive.
And you say that because people accuse you of that?
Yeah. So, for example, once Angela Smith, who is a former Labour, then Independent, then now she's a Liberal Democrat. And she, you know, an investigative journalist did a piece about her support for water privatisation and her links to the private water industry, a piece which I shared, and therefore I was accused of bullying and harassing a politician. And I just thought, no, I'm just a journalist sharing an investigative piece of journalism, which might be very uncomfortable for Angela Smith and the people who support her politics, but you know, I didn't say anything abusive in the slightest. I just shared a piece about her public links to the private water industry. And there's a difference between that and someone yelling or using social media to send profane or misogynistic abuse at somebody like Angela Smith. I don't think anyone would claim that I lack scrutiny. I mean, you know, every single day I have MPs and other political commentators very vehemently and passionately and angrily often denouncing me and my political opinions. Now, that does often lead to abuse. That, you know, if James Cleverly quote tweets me, I will often end up in the replies with homophobic abuse. But I'm not going to say, as a consequence, even if I think his criticisms often are profoundly unfair and often outrageous, I'm not going to say you can't do this because you've led to abuse being whipped up and incited against. But if I did that, I could just use that constantly against the many politicians and commentators and others who angrily denounce me on a daily basis as whipping up this kind of as being responsible for that abuse. They have their right to criticise.
And can I specifically ask you about anti-Semitism? Because there are Jewish politicians like the former MP Luciana Berger who have suffered terrible abuse online. Some of that is from the far right, but a lot of it is from the left as well.
Well, anti-Semitism does exist on a fringe of the left. And, you know, I don't know how many columns I've written now denouncing anti-Semitism on the left, including that directed against Luciana Berger. It's not, you know, the vast majority of the left abhor anti-Semitism. I would say that absolutely without doubt. But there is a broader group of people within the left who I think have been in denial about the existence of anti-Semitism within their ranks and see almost this sense of, well, if the left means being anti-racist, therefore, how can anyone on the left be racist?
Let's talk about some of the stuff you've experienced off social media. This anger shifting from the digital world to the streets. What have you started to see?
Last December
2018,
when I was on air Sky News at College Green, a group of Tommy Robinson supporters screamed profane abuse, which I probably can't repeat on air.
Confidence, that's all to play for.
I think the DUP's...
In January, on the same day the then Conservative MP Anna Soubry was famously chased in the streets by James Goddard, a far-right activist.
Anna, you're a fascist! Anna, fascist!
The same thing happened to me. They chased after me yelling, you know, effing traitor.
Listen, you are a horrible little liar! So how many people attended the festival?
Oh, it's brutal out here.
A few days after the incident in January, I was surrounded by far-right activists yelling, Jonesy is a homo, rent boy and all the rest. And then when I tried, surrounded by stewards, to get to my bike...
Sorry, is that okay if I get that one?
It's just my bike, so... They
were trying to punch me in the face, they spat down my face, and they were yelling...
How do you feel in that situation?
Well, what I did is I filmed it because they're filming you. And what they're trying to do is use the footage of you to create viral content, which they hope is kind of, look, we've got a biggie, we've got a big scalp, we've got Owen Jones, one of our demonic hate figures. And they actually monetize that. They get people to send them money So they make it funds their lifestyle. It's this kind of entrepreneurial far-right activism that's kind of kicked off.
Why are you one of their demonic figures?
I'm gay. I'm a socialist. I'm anti-racist. I despise Islamophobia. That always comes back to that often. It's often about Islamophobia, which is you support Islam, the Islamization of Europe.
I mean, aren't you? I understand, yeah, you don't want to be put off by this stuff because that's what they're trying to do. But in that situation, you must be terrified.
I'm aware that my personal safety and my life is potentially at risk. And I have been for a long time. You know, and it's caused particularly people close to me huge amounts of upset and anxiety. I can't just think about myself. You have to think about all the people around you.
Are there other ways that they target you?
I was doxxed, so my telephone number was circulated and I had lots of far-right activists ringing me. I had someone took a picture of a South Thanet farm where someone had graffitied Hang Owen Jones. And just to make sure, you know, it was clear they weren't talking about a bus driver locally, it said the Guardian paper writer. I guess I'm frustrated because I don't see a way out and I don't see how it gets better.
Owen, what's happened to you is reflected much more broadly. We know that politics has become more divisive in recent years, not least as a result of Brexit.
He's traitors!
Jo Cox was killed by a far-right terrorist.
She was just such a lovely person.
Another Labour MP, Rosie Cooper, had a murder plot against her foiled.
Our democracy is under threat, yes, and we must do our utmost to defend it.
Many MPs I speak to have installed panic buttons in their homes. Is this just a part of our public and political life now?
I think it's important we don't get resigned to this. No one should feel under threat for expressing their political opinions. That's not how a democracy works, quite clearly. But it's also important to broaden it out. What about members of minorities who are being attacked on the streets of this country? We know hate crimes have more than doubled since 2013. What about people who might be listening to this, who have been abused in the streets, spat at, maybe they were holding hands with their partner, maybe they're a Muslim, maybe they're a migrant, whose attackers feel emboldened by that discourse. So I think when we talk about civility in politics, we shouldn't just focus on the anger or the hatred being directed at public figures. We need to talk about people who don't have a platform, who don't have a voice, who are being attacked because of prominent politicians' rhetoric and that of the media as well.
Brexit has been like a lightning rod for abuse in both directions, arguably. But clearly you face some pretty vicious attacks, in part because of your desire for a soft deal or to remain. How do you respond to those type of attacks?
Well, I think we need to be clear that those people do not represent the 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit. I saw newspaper articles when I got harassed describing them as pro-Brexit protesters. Really dangerous when that happens. It's important that we strip them of that sense of you know, being in any sense the representatives of 17.4 million Brexit voters who overwhelmingly abhor these people as disgusting thugs and criminals, which is exactly what they are. But the only way we're going to detoxify this is to stop treating these people as the representatives of Brexit. They're not. And to stop the sort of rhetoric being used on the front pages of newspapers and in the statements of governing politicians, not just against political opponents, but against migrants, refugees, Muslims, benefit claimants, the works, because it's caused hatred and it's radicalising those who will use violence to terrorise their opponents.
Finally, Owen, it doesn't feel very relaxing to be you. I mean, you're on social media, you're facing constant low-level, high-level and violent abuse. You're facing death threats. You're worried about your loved ones because they've been attacked when you've been attacked. Does any of this make you want to stop?
So no, I'm definitely not going to stop. The opposite. When I get harassed and attacked, I think I've got to fight even more loudly, even more determined, even more with more courage and determination to the day I die. And I hope everybody else listening to this will do the same as well.
Owen, thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure.
That was Owen Jones. Do read his columns and watch his videos at theguardian.com. Coming up, The Guardian's North of England editor Helen Pidd on how a prolific rapist in Manchester was finally caught out. Now, this week saw the jailing of the most prolific sex offender in British judicial history. Reynard Sinago was given a life sentence with a minimum term of 30 years. Across 2.5 years, he drugged, raped, and filmed on his phone nearly 200 young men in Manchester, many of whom he met outside clubs before inviting them back to his flat. The nature of his crimes and the sheer number of cases has come as a massive shock to many of Sinaga's friends in Manchester's gay scene. The Guardian's North of England editor, Helen Pidd, attended the trial.
I've covered enough rape trials over my 15 years as a journalist to know that there's no such thing as a typical sex offender. But the first thing that struck me when I looked over to the doc in the first of the trials that I attended is, wow, I would never have thought that that little guy who's so smiley, seems to be joking around with his security guards in the dock, I would never have thought that he was capable of this kind of brutal campaign of rape over 2.5 years. So by the time of the last trial, Sinago was 36 years old. We know that he came to the UK in 2007 from Sumatra and Indonesia on a student visa. And he basically spent the next 10 years just trying to keep studying in order to be in the country legally. He had a few part-time jobs, but mostly he was just studying and more than that, partying, particularly in Manchester's gay scene. Reynard Sinaga's luck ran out on the 2nd of June 2017, in the early hours of the morning, when his final victim, who is this 18-year-old strapping lad over 6 foot, woke up mid-attack. All of the other victims, the other 194, they all slept through their ordeal. But for whatever reason, maybe this lad, he just reacted differently to the drugs. Maybe he wasn't drugged at all. We may never know. But he woke up halfway through, was horrified to find that he was being sexually assaulted by Reynard Sinaga. And he fought him off and beat him up so badly that he actually thought he might have killed Sinaga. There's a 999 call where this lad phones the police and says that he thinks he might have killed somebody and says that he was being raped. The police came round, the paramedics came round, and the police actually arrested the victim rather than Sinaga in the first case. And it was only when they examined the phone that the victim had accidentally taken from the scene that they realised that they'd got the wrong guy. When the police started to analyse these phones, they realised that the final victim was far from the only person that Reynard Sinaga had targeted. And it took them many months to go through the footage because there was so much of it. And they eventually worked out that there were 195 different men who had been recorded by Reynard Sinaga comatose while he raped them, and then began the very unusual and very difficult task of trying to find out who these men were. Now, in some of the cases, it was relatively straightforward because Sinaga was an obsessive documenter, but there are still at least 70 men on those videos who are still unaccounted for. Apart from the final victim, all of the others had no idea that they had been raped at all. For many of these young men, it's been an experience that has really affected their relationships and their mental health. And they've required a lot of counselling from dedicated services in Manchester. Whenever a horrific case like this comes to light, you know, we often look at what lessons can be learnt. But I struggle to actually to see what could be done. What I think is particularly chilling about this case is that it could be any one of us. You know, how many people have been young students who've gone for a night out, had a bit too much to drink, and gone back to somebody's house? You know, it's a very, very common experience. I mean, I live in Manchester, I work in Manchester, I know these nightclubs. So it felt quite personal.
That was Helen Pidd. Follow all her reporting on the website. A number of victims are still coming forward following the release of Sinaga's image, and anyone with information regarding the case can contact Greater Manchester Police on 0800 092 0410. If you've been affected by the case, support from specialist agencies can be found on 0800 056 0154. Numbers may vary if you're dialing from abroad. That's all for today. My thanks to Owen Jones and Helen Pidd. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.